That is the essential message, the essential concept of Ruth, is that we can trust that a God who knows what is good and best is working on our behalf. And it's such a beautiful expression of the hope that we can have. I entitled the series, Finding Hope God's Way, because one of the things that you encounter, and this is true of most illustrations, is you see some people who did it right and you see some people who did it wrong, and you learn from both. Because more often than not, the people who've done it wrong can showcase to us exactly why it's worth doing it right. So we find hope and we do it God's way. So last week we talked a little bit about the historical context of this book. We said that the book of Ruth is essentially a small story within the context of a larger story. And we spent some time talking about the fact that Ruth, this story, as beautiful as it seems, is in a dark place. It's in a dark place in Scripture. This is sort of sandwiched in the broader story of the book of Judges, and this rehearsal of these hundreds of years of a lost sense of the goodness of God, of the nature of God during the darkest time in the history of Israel, really, in many ways. This is where we find this beautiful story sort of shining this light out of the darkness. To me, the thing that I find so interesting about Ruth is it really is shining a light in the midst of darkness, like we titled our study in 1 Peter. It offers a peek into the world of a sovereign and the work of a sovereign and good God as he accomplishes his plans, not despite sinful choices of men, but actually through them. And this was one of the hard things we discussed, is the fact that in our minds, often we get this impression that God is sort of in this epic battle with evil, as if he's the one who's struggling against it. And sometimes evil gets the upper hand, and then other times God gets the other upper hand. And then it switches and it goes back and forth. And the important thing to remember, this is so essential, as we consider that, is that the victory has already been won. To think for a moment that sin can get the best of God is to not know God. God has won the battle. So there's not this fight, this epic struggle between good and evil. Good has already won. Good is the victor. So what is the struggle? The struggle is acknowledging what is true. That's the struggle. To me, it's a little bit like fighting, and I know that Dave Sillette is here, so I'll use this illustration. It's a zombie war, Dave. It's a zombie war. The reality is, they're already dead. But for some reason, we fight them as if they're alive. The evil, the sin that is in us, we treat it as if it's alive, and we end up actually feeding it in our desire to resist it to some degree. That's one of the things that John and I have talked about, and one of the things that I'm sure Dana will address as well at some point, is the fact that there's a sense in which we spend so much of our time and our energy fighting something that is already dead. So what do we do with something that is dead? You leave it dead. Leave it dead. Sin, evil has died. Leave it dead. The thing that we recognize in the book of Ruth is that there's a sense in which, by virtue of the human nature that is within us and within Abimelech and his family, there's a sense in which they ran back to the evil and treated it as if it was alive. Additionally, we reminded ourselves last week that this is a story that shows us that God does work visibly through prophets and miracles, certainly, but also that he is invisibly and carefully working all of the other times too, even inside of tragedy. The thing I like about the story of Ruth is that it is such a quote-unquote small story. And what I mean by that is that there's not the epic nature that you encounter in a lot of the other books and the stories of Judges. There's not, you know, stakes through the heart and people being dismembered and all of this other stuff. It's a small story set in a small context. And much of what God does in the book of Ruth is almost imperceptible if you're not aware of the hand of God and his character. And we know that's true. Why? One of the things that we recognize, it's interesting, one of the things we see even in the book of Ruth is that most of the people didn't realize it was God at work until after the fact. They didn't even see it. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the narrative this morning. You recognize that there's a sense in which the blindness that comes through normal, small, everyday living can kind of make you miss the fact that God is at work. But the beauty of God is that he does not always shout. He does not always send fire. He is not always a whirlwind of activity. Sometimes God is whispering to us. Why do we love that part of God? Why is that an important piece of the character of God? Because we need that so desperately. I need that. It is difficult for me to sit still long enough to have a whispered conversation with my Savior. I can't hear it because I'm so active. I'm so anxious to see his hand in such magnificent ways that I miss the beauty of a God who can moment by moment in intimacy whisper to me truth. There's an intimacy to a whisper. There's a closeness. There's a nearness to that. That is the kind of God we serve. If God only ever thundered from the distance, we may assume that he is what often our world perceives of other gods. This Olympus-style guy ruling from a mountain, distant and separate from me, and has no interest in me. But to imagine a God who is willing to whisper, to tell me quiet things I need to hear, not to change my circumstances, but to show me his hand in the midst of my circumstances, that is a God we need to know. And that, frankly, is the hardest God to believe. That's the one that we struggle the most to hear. And if you want an illustration of that, you only have to go to Elijah. As he sits there waiting for God and wanting God to do the same things that he had seen. And God says, Elijah, I need you to trust me. I have and am doing things for the sake of my glory. There are thousands of people who have not bowed their knee to Baal. Do not get caught up in the sense that I am not here. And certainly in the midst of tragedy, one of the things we encounter in the book of Ruth is sort of a mixture of this struggle. Now remember, we talked about the lies that the deceiver tries to tell us in the midst of struggle. In the middle of trouble, in the middle of persecution, there are a number of lies that tend to make their way against the truth. So what are some of the main lies? What would you say are two of probably the biggest lies, especially when the struggle is quote-unquote unwarranted? When I didn't do something to earn the discipline, if it just happens to be a problem, what are two of the biggest lies that tends to come against us? We've talked about this. We need to know them so we can identify them. Yes, ma'am.
God is not good and God is not great.
Right. God is not good or God is not great. Those are two of the largest lies that come against us. Either God is not altogether good, because why would he let things that hurt happen to people that don't deserve it? Why do bad things happen to good people? That's a question that not just our culture, our world asks, but we ourselves ask. How come God lets hard things, hurtful things, tragedies come against his people? And that's not a new question. Not at all. That's a question that was in the heart and mind of many people. If you want to know somebody that asked that question honestly, read David. David spends an awful lot of time asking that question of God. Why, God? Why is this happening? Why do the evil succeed while the good fail? Why? That question is at the heart of man. And it's not wrong to ask the question, but it's wrong to tell yourself a lie as a result of the question. So the answer to that question is, he is good even in the struggle. Because he's won, right? He is good. I don't believe that. I can't believe that. Because how could this bad be good? And the answer is, you're not God. So trust God. He has good intended for you in the struggle. He promised. Do we believe him? I don't know. It's easy to say it. God brings together good, works together all things for good to them that love him and are called according to his purpose, his way, his plan. Is that true? Well, it's easy to say that in our minds and our hearts when we're on the top, right about ready to go over the hill. Everybody puts their hands up. Halfway down, more than three quarters are holding on, right? You can't keep your hands up the whole time unless you've done it too many times. And it's hard. In the middle of that, I know I'm strapped in, but I don't feel like I'm strapped in. So I'm going to strap myself in that sense of wanting to grab something. Yeah, put your hands up, woohoo! Everybody does it until you get to that point where you realize this is hard. This is scary. Believing God and saying all things, even tragedy, work together for good because God is good. That's the first thing. And secondly, the question of his greatness. Is he in fact all powerful? Is he truly? Because if he was, why wouldn't he change things? If God is as powerful as he claims to be, why won't he change things? And again, you can ask the question, but you have to respond with the truth. The truth is, he can, but he's choosing not to. What kind of God? The best kind. The kind that loves you truly. Because otherwise, and it's easy to think of this if you're a parent, if we want God to be that kind of parent that lets us have whatever we want, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you've even seen a kid that gets everything they want, you know that's not good. That is not a good God. A good God recognizes our needs more than our wants, understands what we need. So the question becomes, in tragedy, is God in fact working? Additionally, another lie that comes when we've experienced our own sin, when we have done wrong and are being chastised, the question is different then. The question is, can I be forgiven? I can't. I've done too wrong. That's the other lie that comes against us. That actually flips the narrative, right? That's when we proclaim the truth almost beyond what is true. We say, oh, God is so great and so good, he could never love me again. That is also a lie. God has said, I am so great and so good, and I do love you still. And I continue to forgive, and I continue to change. So the interesting thing about the book of Ruth is that you see a little bit of both. You see tragedy, which is really sort of unwarranted suffering, but you also see chastisement. Suffering that comes as a direct result of bad choices that people make. And in both of them, you see the hand of God. That's the beauty, is that in both instances, you see God who is actively participating in the narrative to showcase his glory. This is a story for all of us who will sometimes doubt whether God is in control or is good, and whether faithfulness to do what is right is really worth it. It's a story for people who question whether all things, including suffering, are truly designed for our good. This is a story to help us see what is true. So, let's read together. And I know we read this a little bit last week, but once again, Ruth 1:1-22. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. And they were Ephratites from Bethlehem of Judah, and they went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech and the husband of Naomi died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and without her husband. Last week we said that this story really is seen from the perspective of Naomi. She's sort of the chief she's the one that sees and perceives this story. She's the character through whose eyes we're going to encounter this story. And so it's important to understand that Chris was asking a question last week. He asked whether or not I thought that this was something that was heard, depending on when and who wrote this, and there's some debate about that. Some have suggested that it might be Samuel, which I think could be a good option. The question could be whether or not he himself actually had firsthand knowledge or an account from Ruth. And there is, depending on when the writing was, there's an entirely real possibility that he had heard her rehearse her, it would have been from Ruth, but rehearsed her story, so from her mother's perspective. Sorry. Anyway, don't talk to Chris. Don't talk to me. So here we have this story, this narrative that's given to us, to offer us a little bit of a sense of this story. So we dive right in, and it's not one of those once upon a time in a land far, far away, everything was bright and cheery. It reminds me a little bit of the start of all my illustrations are animated, because that's what I watch. Lemony Snickets, right? Lemony Snickets, when it starts with like a little elf and everything's happy, and then this is the wrong story. If you're here to watch that, you're not in the right story. This story starts dark. It says, in the time when the judges ruled. That there tells you this was in a time when everybody did what was right in their own eyes. There was dark across the face of the land. And it starts with a story about suffering. It says that there was a famine in the land. So you're supposed to set yourself in the scene. The story is begun, and we say this is a time when there is darkness, when there is disbelief, when no one really seems to know or love God. And in that context, now make a famine. A famine was in the land. One of the things that you recognize is the names. And again, whenever you're reading an Old Testament narrative especially, make sure that you clue into the names. I know I appreciate how the Jim's Club have spent so much time talking about the names of God, because names matter in the Bible. Names are important. They help set the stage, so to speak. And these names were very significant. So we started with the first name, Elimelech, which means my God is king. Elimelech's name was where we started. This man is named Elimelech, and he is expressing through his name that God is king. What does that tell you? If that's what he's named, what does that suggest? And I understand that this is a question that could be up to debate, but certainly if we're looking at the names, if this individual is named, my God is king, what might that say about his heritage? They believed in God. Thank you, sir. You're brilliant. They believed in God. This is an acknowledgement of his parents that my God is king. Now, could they mean some other God? I suppose. But the context and the structure there would imply that they're speaking of Yahweh. My God is king. So Elimelech's name starts and introduces us to this individual who is, by virtue of his own name, proclaiming the kingship or sovereignty of God. Naomi means God is sweet or means pleasant. God is sweet or God is pleasant. That is a beautiful name. That is a wondrous name. That's a name that I would name one of my kids. And in fact, I did. My Naomi, we mix their names, but certainly part of that concept of the sweet or the pleasure or the pleasantness of the relationship we can have with God is built into her name, right? So God is king marries God is pleasant and sweet. So that is the names of the individual that are then placed into this setting. And the setting is dark and dismal, and the setting is a famine. So then we're introduced to two sons during this period of time. So here's where you see something important, a difference. So the son, the first son, is named Malon, which means sick. All right, so this tells you something, correct? You go from God is sweet, or my God is pleasant, God is king, to sick. Now, does that mean he was a sickly child? Some have suggested that. I suppose it's entirely possible that that's the case. Regardless of the fact, they named this son a name that no one would really want to be named. If you're a kid, Ainsley, don't ever pick the name sick. All right, unless you mean like sick, that's sick. That's about the only way you'd ever want that name. Sick, why would you name your kid sick? That's miserable, even if the kid was sick. You could say there is hope in sickness or something. You could find a way to make it better. But instead, this is what you live with. For the rest of your life, your name is sick. And the other one means decay or dying. So as if sick wasn't enough, now we're going to name the second kid decay or dying. What we assume by this is a number of things. First off, there was a clarity to the understanding of Elimelech and of Naomi. The fact that these children were born into a scenario where things are difficult. Suffering and tragedy is very real. And even the names of the children reflect the heart and the understanding of the individuals. You are acknowledging the reality of your situation. And these kids are named appropriately. They are called these names purposefully to showcase the nature of what they were encountering. The inspiration of the names of these boys come through the conditions in which they lived, likely. They are in the middle of a famine, which is most likely a judgment from God. Why do we say that a famine is most likely a judgment from God? Because God himself says that. Multiple times in Scripture, he reminds us that famine, especially in this context, is judgment. It's a reminder to the people of who is the one who gives and who takes. Now, why is that important? Well, one of the things we see often in Judges is the fact that God uses these struggles to bring the hearts of his people back to him. Interestingly enough, Bethlehem has it bad. The house of bread, Bethlehem, could not find anything to eat. So this is the story that we find ourselves in. These individuals who started out from a perspective saying perhaps God is greater good and he is also sweet, moved to sick, decay, dying, and we're living in an untruth. We don't actually live in the house of bread. We live in the house of hunger. And so in that context, we discover that Elimelech decides to make a call. He says, I am going to move my family to Moab. Now, Moab is an interesting place. First off, we know enough. You guys have heard this story often enough. Was that an appropriate choice for him to make? Elimelech, was that the right answer? Some of you are sort of hesitantly shaking your heads no. Why the hesitant no? Why would it be wrong for him to make that call? Right, Moab is an enemy of Israel. And an enemy of God. Moab is an enemy of Israel and an enemy of God. They do not believe what the Israelites were to believe about God. Moab was the result of, they are the descendants of one of the daughters of Lot. These individuals in Moab do not have the same attitude or heart about God. And because of that, their culture, their ideas, they were tainted by false understanding, false gods, correct? Can we agree with that? And God said, he told his people, do not go and partner there. Why? Because you will get sucked into the perspective, into the worldview that has permeated their system. And yet what we encounter is that Elimelech makes the call to go to Moab. Now, before we get too judgmental here with Elimelech, let's remind ourselves of the situation. Because it's easy to say, psh, that guy. What's wrong with that dude? Doesn't he know any better? And the answer is certainly he may. Perhaps he doesn't, but he may. But outside of even that, what would have motivated Elimelech's action? Sorry? My family is starving. Guys, it is so easy to judge. To look at this guy and to say, come on, man. Be a man. Be the one who stands in the gap. Go. Show your family the goodness of God. Stop for a moment and consider. My family is starving. My family is dying. The world around me is crumbling, and you're asking me to stay put and to watch them suffer. That is a difficult call. Guys, this is easy to judge, but put yourself in his shoes for a moment, his sandals, I suppose. My family is dying. And he hears there is food in Moab. Now, is there a way to justify this action? Certainly. I could tell you just in 5 minutes ways that if I were in his shoes, how I could spiritualize my choice. Well, God obviously is blessing Moab. Clearly, God's hand is with Moab. And perhaps that's because they actually know God better than we do. And so I'm going to take my family to Moab so they can learn more of God. I mean, I could think of a million ways we could justify this action. Elimelech makes the call to go and to take his family to Moab. But one of the things that is dramatically missing from this narrative is prayer. Could it be that God intends for individuals to leave Israel and to go to foreign lands and align with them? Yes. What happened with David? That, a lot. But the difference is David was following the directives of God. In this instance, Elimelech is trying his best to manage his situation. And it's easy for us to judge, but we also recognize the heart from which that's coming. So after he moves his family to Moab, Elimelech dies. And tragedy is added to suffering. So they already are suffering. And we can make the argument that the suffering that they're experiencing is a result of the sin of the nation of Israel, certainly. But the tragedy that begins to pour itself out on the house of Elimelech is a little bit different. Some people have suggested or tried to suggest that this is only because Elimelech made the choice that he made, and so God is punishing Elimelech. I would say it's bigger than that. I would say that there's more going on here than even just the fact that God is sort of in wrath judging Elimelech. I think that God is using the tragedy of the choices that he's made to, you know, the natural consequences of that are adding suffering on top of or tragedy on top of suffering. And in that moment, we see Elimelech dying. But then again, there's a hope here. And so death is a common thing. In this culture, it's not like, in our minds, we think, wow, that's horrifying. And it certainly is. But we're not told how old Elimelech is. We're also not told, you know, a lot of things about this. So it may have been a little bit more of a natural scenario where he passes away. But the hope's still there for Naomi, because in this instance, you have two young sons who will care for her. So she says, there's still hope in my scenario. Yes, I've lost my husband. And she does say later that God has taken my husband from me. But she also says, there's still hope because I have my two sons. And so in that instance, we can see that, you know, in spite of the fact that they're in this moment of suffering, there still seems to be sort of this glimmer of hope for Naomi. They live as one family for about 10 years, and neither the young, and so one of the things that happens in between this is the fact that these two boys realize, I've got to care for mom, we've got to take care of the situation, and so they end up taking wives for themselves from the Moabites, which, by the way, you know, it's easy for us again to say, well, how dare they do this? And I agree, it was the wrong call, it was the wrong choice, but this is common sense to some degree. They're there, the women are there, this is where we lived, this is where we've been living, dad is buried here. We are going to take women from these people. So they take these two wives. And in that instance, we see this beginning of sort of this hopeful scenario. In the midst of tragedy and in the midst of suffering, there might be some hope. But the thing that's interesting is for these 10 years, and I think sometimes we read right past that 10 years. In our mind, we sort of just push this narrative forward. But don't forget, 10 years is a while. 10 years is actually quite a while. And for 10 years, Naomi and her two sons and their two wives live together sort of in this single family. 10 years is a long while to be living, to be struggling, to be trying to carve a living for yourself out in the Moabitish area. And one of the things that we recognize in particular, this is something that crossed my mind as I was reading this, is that during those 10 years, there are no children. Now, I know that we might just read and run right past that, but I don't think we should. Because in that, you can see these glimmers, like I'm talking about, of the way that God is orchestrating the situation to the best end possible. 10 years for this culture to not have children after marriage is very, very unusual. This is almost unheard of. This seems almost supernaturally unusual. And during that period of time, God allows for there not to be children introduced into the system. What would the children have done? Well, A, they would have complicated the situation later, knowing the fact that these two boys are going to die. That would have made it much more difficult for Naomi and for the women. But it also would have changed the nature of the relationship between Ruth and between her mother-in-law, and then later in the story between Boaz. I mean, the whole thing would be different. It's interesting how God is extending grace. God is extending mercy and inserting himself into the situation, and something that could be seen certainly as a tragedy. Frankly, if I was one of those two boys, and I didn't know I was going to die in 10 years, I'm thinking, what is going on? I have no children. I have no heirs. We're trying to push forward here. We've been here for 10 years. This is home. And yet we're not building our family like we anticipated. And there may be a sense in which the mind of these boys are kind of wondering, wow, this is difficult. This is suffering. But certainly later we discover that the two sons also die. Just like her husband, now Naomi herself individually is struggling to find work. Her family is suffering. So the weight of the responsibility now rests fully on her, and she begins to weigh her options. And in that weight, she hears or discovers that bread has returned to Bethlehem. And so she determines in her own mind, what am I doing? Why bother? Why stay? What do I have here worth staying for? And that's a fair question. Her husband has died. Now her two sons have died. She's left with these two daughter-in-laws. Now, in the story, often we have this tendency to run to the conclusion that Orpah was sort of this unlovable. I mean, we love to kind of paint her in a certain way because it sort of heightens in our own mind the drama. But these women have been bound together by tragedy. Don't forget what they've experienced collectively together. Naomi has experienced the death of her husband. And then these two women have also experienced the deaths of their husbands. And Naomi has lost sons. And they have struggled in this environment to see the goodness and greatness of God. And in that, they begin to knit their hearts together. When we encounter later in the story the commitment that's made between the women, recognize that that stems from that mutuality to suffering. They know each other's pain. They understand that pain to some degree. And so in this moment, Naomi, in her sorrow, she decides, why am I staying here? What have I here that's worth staying for? I might as well go home. And I understand that in the sense that she really, either way, she is lost in her own mind. And so she determines to go home. Then she arose. This is in the next verses. She arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with the two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. And they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. Now, one of the things that I find fascinating in this section here, one of the things that's important to notice, is that when Naomi makes the decision that this is what should happen, she recognizes the fact that she really has nothing to offer to these girls. And so she says, and she even appeals to the Lord. Notice this. She says, may the Lord bless you. May the Lord grant you these things. So there's a sense in which she still instinctively is speaking what she knows to be true about Yahweh. And she proclaims a blessing on these daughter-in-laws, but she says it really makes more sense for you to stay. And that is a fair argument. Quite honestly, that's a fair argument she's assessing. She's saying, why would you come with me? In fact, if we go a little further, but Naomi said, this is her argument. This is sort of her anti-evangelism campaign where she's saying, no, don't come. Don't believe. Don't follow. She says, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way. For I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you wait and refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for you, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So she makes a statement. She begins to sort of proclaim what is true. I believe this proclamation. So some people like to blame Naomi here and to say, how dare she? She has an opportunity to win these two souls to Christ. And really, she misses the mark here. But don't forget what motivates Naomi's heart here. Out of love, she recognizes truthfully that she has nothing to offer. Out of this spirit of love, this weeping that's going on, these women sincerely care for each other in love. But Naomi recognizes that there does not appear to be hope. And so she says, she tries to convince them out of this hopelessness of following her. Practically speaking, she's right. There is no tangible hope with her. She says, where's the hope, guys? Where's the hope for me? Is there hope that I might be able to give you options when we get back to where I'm going? I have nothing to give you. I'm a widow who's too old to work. I have no extended family to care for me. Notice in Naomi's expression here, she herself really has no hope. As she's proclaiming this truth to her daughter-in-laws, she's saying what she believes about her situation as well. She's saying, I'm a widow. I'm too old to have a husband. I have no family. There's no reason for you to come and die with me. Really, I'm just going home to die. I'm going to go there and I'm going to die because that's all the options I have left for myself. Why would you come with me if that's my plan? And that's a fair statement. If that was what she intended, if that was what she thought in her own mind, that there's really no hope back here, but at least I'll be among my family. Why would you encourage your daughter-in-law to come? I have no more sons for you to marry, no brother, no relative to marry the widow and to continue the brother's name. And this is interesting as well, because here we are introduced to the plot twist, right? Do you see it? Do you recognize what she's proclaiming? I have no family. I have no sons to do the kinsman redeemer thing. She herself already is beginning to recognize a very important piece of what God is going to do. She's proclaiming the possibility. If I was able to have a son, then he would, by our custom, marry the daughters, and they would be brought under the wing of the son. And so she knows even in this moment that there is this redeemer's option. But in her mind, the only way that works is if I have a baby, and if I had a baby, you wouldn't be able to wait long enough for my sons to get old enough, and then you marry them, and that'd be weird. So this doesn't make sense. It's not reasonable for you to expect that I would have a redeemer to be able to reach you. She is proclaiming what she believes to be true. But what she does not realize is that God himself is in charge of the scenario. And the option that she thinks is so far removed from reasonable possibility is the one by which God was going to rescue and save. And this is important, certainly for us, because in this we see the hand of God and recognize that often in our experience, the thing that seems most unlikely, the thing that we know could solve all our problems, but we say, but of course that's not going to be, because, you know, does God even really do that anymore? That sense of doubt where we see even her own rescue and can't recognize it for what it is the nature of suffering. Suffering blinds us and gives us these blinders that don't allow us to see. Even when we say the potential for hope, we can't see it for what it is. I am exceedingly bitter, was her expression, and that's true. And in that bitterness, she missed even the thing that God was going to use to rescue. I will die as a widow, and so will you with me. So basically, she says, if I go and die, you're dying too. So why would you come be part of that? And finally, I have bitterness and a God who hates me. God was behind the famine, the trip to Moab, the death of my husband, and the death of my son. She is acknowledging actually pretty good theology. Truth be told, really, she should maybe be named My God is King, because she is saying God's in charge of this whole thing. But she's not saying it in a sense of hope, right? She's saying it in a sense of bitterness. And here's something important for us to recognize. Often when we proclaim the truth about the nature of God's sovereignty, especially when it stems from suffering, be cautious of that proclamation. Because your proclamation of the sovereignty of God, while true, may not come from a spirit of recognizing the goodness of God. Oh, God is sovereign. I have heard this. I remember specifically a pastor who grew up, he became a pastor. He was a young man at the church that I grew up in. And he went off to school and became a very effective pastor in the Midwest. And one night he hit a rollerblader, turned a corner, dark, and the rollerblader was in the middle of the road, no marking, nothing. He could not have helped that situation. And he hit him and he killed him. And it crushed him. He took a sabbatical from the ministry. When he came back, he had a different idea about who God was. He changed his allegiance. He changed his theology. He decided that everything has been predisposed by God to happen, and there's nothing I can do to change it. And because that's true, he was so fatalistically impacted. And I know where that stemmed from. It's not because he was some wicked theologian. It was because his heart broke over the pain of causing the death of this promising young... the guy was a hockey player, which in the Midwest is practically the president. And he killed him. And in his heart, he thought, how... God, how could you let this happen? And he concluded that God was sovereign, but he lost sight of the goodness of God. And in that moment, he became so captured by that idea that really he became bitter. He became bitter, and he lost the goodness of God. And in some senses, we can proclaim what is true, but we need individuals to check even that truth and to say, I hear what you're saying, and I know you mean it as true, and it is true, but do not forget the other part of this equation. You will get lost, and that theology will eat you, and you will forget God. And in this instance in particular, her bitterness was causing Naomi to miss the nature of God. And she said, see, your sister-in-law. So Ruth continues to cling to Naomi, but she says, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said, "No more." Now this is beautiful. This is something that we've recognized, and not just us, but society as a whole, our culture, is fascinated and attracted to the loyalty that's described there. That expression, this covenant expression that she makes with Naomi, is so filled with a sense of promise, with a sense of hope, and she proclaims what is true. One of the things I think is important to recognize here as well is the fact that she attaches the name of the Lord. May the Lord, may Yahweh do to me. So she herself is beginning to run full bore into the suffering that Naomi aptly proclaimed as the possibility of her future. And she said, "May the Lord do so to me. I am ready to die because I am loyal to you." Now that loyalty that we see in Ruth is not something that we can say necessarily. It's hard to identify why in particular that occurred. Why did she become so loyal? Was this just her personality? Did she see something in Naomi? Did she see something in God? We're not sure. But frankly, this expression of commitment to Naomi was so convincing, was so wholehearted that Naomi decided, "Well, I guess you can come with me then." So from there, we move on. They're walking down the road. And the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. That I find fascinating. The whole town was stirred because of them. And this is hard for us to imagine because culturally we're not in the same place as they would have been. But they were blown away. They were amazed to see Naomi returning. And there was a great stir in the land, which suggests that they were somewhat notorious, but also it suggests an agrarian economy where everybody wants to know everybody's business and, you know, the party line kind of thing. Everybody's like, "Hey, did you hear Naomi came back? Yeah, how's she look? Not good. You should go check it out." And so there's this parade that happens sort of as they're returning and she's coming home, and they see the whole town is stirred up with the fact that she's back. And the women said, and I love this, is the ladies. This is the question the ladies ask. The women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said that to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" The women of town are blown away by her visage, by the nature of her walking into town. Even that was so astounding, arresting, that they couldn't help themselves. "What has happened to you? Can this really be Naomi?" And Naomi loudly proclaims what she believes to be true. She preaches what she believes in her heart is 100% the truth. And she says, "The Lord has testified against me, the Almighty." She recognizes the sovereignty of God, but she is bitter against that sovereignty. "I am filled with bitterness. The powerful God that we serve has crushed me and taken everything from me, and I have nothing." Is that true? It's not. It's not true. Here's the thing about perspective with suffering. You lose sight of what's true. Why is she back? Why is she back? She's back because God is blessing. "I've come back empty." Stop. Hear yourself for a moment. You're back because God has extended mercy. But you missed that. She's empty. Is that true? What has just occurred? Frankly, put yourself in Ruth's shoes for a moment. "Really, Ma? I just told you I'm with you till death. But apparently I don't matter because you're empty. You have nothing. There's no hope for you." Naomi lost perspective because of the bitterness of her experience. Now, do we judge her? In one sense, I suppose. We learn from her experience. One of the things we talked about at the end of 1 Peter is the importance of perspective. And it is so simple, so easy for us to fall into this idea that God has completely abandoned us, that we miss the whispers. And by the way, the idea that God has returned miraculously bred to Jerusalem or to Bethlehem, and the fact that Ruth has clung to her side and wept with her and proclaimed her loyalty is not small, certainly. But compared to the struggle, to the suffering she experienced, I'll grant it's hard to see. There are times when we need people to remind us of those important things. Friends, when we say we have nothing, most often it's because we're unwilling to see what we have. And that's hard to hear when you're suffering. Nobody wants to actually hear all the good. Count your many blessings, name them one by one. You know what? I agree with the theology, but the reality is much more difficult than that. When we experience the crushing that happens often, the suffering, which we may or may not have brought on ourselves, it is so hard to keep fixated on what is true about God. And that's when we need others to point us to the truth. And in this instance, Naomi proclaims what is true in her heart. Do we judge her for her truth? No, we recognize that she sees this, but we also recognize a lack of perspective, which is dangerous. We need to keep hold of the truth or have others proclaim that to us. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. I find that even such a wonderful thing, because God has brought them back in the moment when they can actually, right from the get-go, receive what they need, right? If it had been 2 months till barley harvest, well, those 2 months would have been tough. But in this moment, God brings them back right when they can participate in something that will help them, that will give them what they need. So here are some practical responses, just in closing quickly, some practical things that we see, these responses to suffering. So where did the suffering start? Who's the first person that responded to suffering in our story? Elimelech, right? Elimelech. What was his response to suffering? So what did he encounter in his family and in his situation? Suffering, famine. And how did he respond? God is king, yes, but I will make this work. I can fix my problem. I'm telling you, and for you ladies in particular, you might recognize this as true. This is the heart of a guy to some degree. Not saying that women also don't perceive this. But, man, I got to work my problem. I will do what I can do. And then God can make up the difference. I can manage this. I can do this. I can fix the problem. Elimelech, the first illustration of suffering, was that he hoped really in himself. I can solve the problem. I can fix this. I know the solution. He hoped in himself. Suffering happens often to individuals who are so filled up with their own plans that they need crushed because they're so filled with their own agenda, and God brings the suffering and Elimelech says, I know the solution. Let's do it this way. And he runs to his own understanding rather than recognizing the goodness of God and being willing to patiently wait for God's answer. Guys, this is hard. This is so difficult. To be able to wait for God to move, especially if you are this planner type like Elimelech, is one of the most difficult things you can imagine. Because you say, well, I'm going to starve while I'm waiting. I'm going to sit here and my whole family's going to die. Is this really what I want? Is this really what God wants? A willingness to wait for God to move is difficult. But really, at the end of the day, that's where Peter makes the statement. Resist the devil by casting your anxieties on God because he cares for you. Anxieties is this, right? It's, what do I do? I got to come up with a plan. Okay, let's see here. Well, I can't do that. Got it. Okay, what about this? Well, I know it's crazy, but what if we move to Moab? Look, I know no one likes that idea, and I know it's going to make us outcast in our society, and I know maybe, you know, the whole old traditional approach, you know, the traditionalists won't like it, and maybe God won't like it, but boy, it's a good plan. And that anxiety, that anxiousness to come up with a solution drove him to hope in himself, and that hope died with him, right? If your hope is in yourself, when he died, now what are they left with? Naomi, who followed him into that, was also hoping in him and in his plan. What if you as an individual are allowing the people that are leading or that you are leading to hope in you? You are giving them dead hope. You are dying. You can't meet their needs eternally. You are not God. So don't let people hope in you. Guys, this is one of the biggest challenges, one of the biggest sin areas in my own heart. Is that I like to help. And there are times when I inadvertently throw on my pastor cape and fly to the aid of the people around me. And the concern becomes I become Messiah. Whether I mean to or not, I become your Savior. I can't do that because what's going to happen? If you trust in me, I tell you this with all of my heart and soul because I've seen it. My past, my history, my heritage is filled with individuals who have set themselves up as the hope of the church. And have failed. And in the process, God's name has been demoted and distorted in the minds of God's people. Do not hope in me, and don't allow me to plan, you know, for hope in me. I need you to check this in my own heart. Men, we need to check this in our own hearts. Women as well. What about Orpah? Well, really, at the end of the day, she makes sense. She sort of would represent in the story sort kind of the unbeliever who for a while may perceive the goodness of God. It reminds me a little of the soils. Well, I like the family. I love my mother-in-law. There was an apparent nearness. It's not like Orpah was this one that no one liked. I mean, they were all weeping together. She loved Naomi too. But when things get difficult, when she encountered the struggle, she hoped in false gods. She ran back to, it says she returned to her gods, right? Essentially, she said, you know what? You got a good point. Why am I going along with you when I have alternatives back home? You know, and for a lot of people who trust in Christ, there's a sense in which they themselves will start by saying, yes, I love God. I want to believe in God. But when the rubber meets the road, when it becomes difficult and they're suffering, it's much easier to say, why am I going through this problem? I could suffer in other ways without having to put myself through it by believing in God. I'll just go back to what I know. I'll just go back and lean on my own understanding and what I used to have. And so she returns to the hope that she perceived in her situation back home. And we don't know anything about that. So what did she get out of that deal? Well, we don't know. We're not told. Maybe she went back to her mother's house. Maybe she found another husband. Maybe she had another family. Great. But what eternally did that get her? It just extended the hopelessness a little bit longer, perhaps, but it's still dying hope. Naomi. What did Naomi do? How did she respond to suffering? She hopes in nothing. There is no hope. She sat in her bitterness. Now, she acknowledged God, but did she hope in God? No. She said, God has no hope. There is no hope with me. Why would you stay with me? There's nothing here. I believe in God, absolutely, but it's not worth following, trust me. That attitude is terrifying. That heart attitude that says, there's really nothing here. I believe that that God is who he says he is, but it's not really worth following, is certainly not true hope. And so Naomi sits in her bitterness instead of hoping in God and in the hope that God could offer, at least initially. Now I know that the good news is there's restoration there, and that's the other hope we have, is that even when we have false understanding, God through his grace can extend to us the truth. And then finally, Ruth hopes in a God she barely knows. And I find that interesting. Ruth, the Moabitess, is the one who trusts by faith the God she barely knows. What reason would Ruth have to trust in this God? Honestly, what does she know of this God? He is wrathful. He is bitter. I've lost my husband. You think of where she was at and you recognize there's something very special about her spirit. Her willingness to run completely, 100%, into the arms of a God she barely knows is beautiful and amazing. And she's the Moabitess. Don't miss that. There's a reason, I believe, God put that piece into this picture. Because the Moabitess is the one you wouldn't expect this measure of faith from, correct? She's the foreigner. She's the one that no one likes. She's the one that God has cursed. And yet she's the one who hopes in that God in spite of everything. Man, if ever you were going to run, it'd be when your mother-in-law says, I'm empty. All I got is the Moabitess. And yet she continues to extend and push into this relationship with a God that she loves and doesn't yet know to love, but loves as best she knows how. And what ends up happening? I know we keep saying this every week. She becomes part of God's story of redemption. The small redeemer, the small redemption story is a lens through which we see the larger story of redemption. This is beautiful. We talked about diversity. I don't want to read past this yet, because one of the things we see even here is the fact that God uses purposefully the one that if you are a nationalist, you wouldn't want to be the hero of the story. And yet God sets her up and says she had faith in a God she barely knew. And she, in beauty, expresses that truth. So, suffering. It begins. It's difficult. We must respond to this suffering, and we recognize in each of these individuals the human condition. We see our own heart, perhaps, in any one of these places. We can recognize our own propensity to how we respond to suffering. Next week, we're going to read in a little further in the story, and we're going to see the beauty of how God, not next week, hold on, I'm going to talk about that in a second, but we're going to see the beauty of how God moves and shapes this particular story. Is there anything additional anybody wants to add, subtract? Yeah. Is it really?
It's interesting to see how the contrast between Orban and how, you know, like you said, Elimelech should not have gone to Moab. They certainly should have married Moabites when they. And then when they come back, Deuteronomy says that a Moabite will not be allowed into the assembly up to the 10th generation.
Right.
And so here's the thing.
I'm here.
You know, and then of course she's in the line of Christ. See how, like you said, meaning that God doesn't work in spite of men's people, he actually works through them. And how everyone, whether they're Jew or Gentile, has the opportunity to think about that story if they choose to follow God.
Yeah.
And that, I mean,
in
a nutshell, but that's also the story of Ruth, where, you know, Orpah had the same opportunity.
Certainly.
Just as much of an outcast, just as much of her. And she said, I'm not going to go, I'm just going to stay with what I know.
Yeah.
And Ruth had no business going, and yet she's not only welcomed, but she's in the line of sight.
Yeah. What a God. And that's important. Don't read past that. That is significant because that shapes theology. This story is filled with theology. It tells us the character of God. It tells us the character of ourselves. And we see already, like I said, this lens through which the whole of the gospel begins to become unfolded in front of us. What else? Excellent. Well, thank you for your great attention this morning. I appreciate it. I want to talk to you a little bit about next week because it's going to be different. I know we're out of time, but so this next week we've